Station number 16722, Captain George Ledger, Reel 17.
Reel 17. You were beginning to tell about the time you had to your first punishment experience.
I had been with the Indian Army for about a fortnight and was up in the desert in the forward lines, and one day there was a Subedar Major came along to me and he asked me if he could talk to me a while. And I said yes, and he took me into a room which turned out to be the room they used to carry out the business of the running the company and such it was a tent, but it was classed as the company office. And he explained to me that shortly, he says, he had to explain this to me because he knew I was a newly commissioned officer from the college. And that he had a person, one of his private ranks, who had been misbehaving, and he had to be brought into the control room for punishment, or to have it sorted out. And he explained to me exactly which way I had to do it. Now this Subedar Major, he could speak English as good as I could, better than me actually. And he explained, in your case, he said, if you'd just let me advise you, would you? And I says, yes, certainly, in this case. He says, well, and he explained the position regarding the chap. And apparently he had been just disobeying orders, commands out in the desert. It wasn't a matter of being cowardice or anything. It was just disobeying orders to carry out some duties which the Subedar Major wanted done. It had something to do with the cook house. Eventually, he wouldn't be carrying some of the materials required at the cook house from one point to another. A simple thing like that. But he explained to me, the Subedar Major said, I've been asked, actually, by the colonel, the company commander, rather, to let you do this just to put you in a position as a new second lieutenant, as a new commissioned officer. How do we deal with them in the Indian Army? And so he explained to me what he did. It was more or less similar to what they do in the British Army, exactly, but in my case, not being able to understand the language, it had to be done through people telling me what he was saying to me. The chap, when he was brought in front of me, they marched him in front of me, and I was at the table by this time, and the Subedar Major asked him to remove his hat. He took his cap off, removed that, and stood to attention. And then the Subedar Major said the man's name and his rank. So I asked him what his problem was, and he started to talk to me in Roman Urdu, which I couldn't understand. And therefore, it had to be interpreted by the Subedar Major back to me and to him. And eventually it turned out, I'd already been told that if you awarded him 3 days CB, he says, it would serve the purpose in this case. So that was my first case of issuing punishment out as a second lieutenant, as a commissioner.
What was discipline like in an Indian unit? Was it firmer than it was in a British unit?
It was very, very firmer. In the Indian unit, the short while I was with them, when you're in a position where you're on a war footing, it's different entirely to when you're just at home training, and the difference is really exasperating. You know, there's no inclination that you're going to get killed, sort of thing. You know, you're just there. And you're thinking, I'm here on training. You're not on training. run an active service. And that's the church, just a few hundred yards away. And this is what I had to learn to accept ourselves. So more so as territorial soldiers, we had never seen any action. We went across from the one we had in Arras, in France. But the discipline to me, the short time I was with them, it seemed to be quite normal. As we did, there's a lot of dissent as we did in the British regiments with the various troops, but they all seemed eventually to get together and get the work done.
Was there any open dissent towards the British officers of an Indian unit?
I never heard, the whole time I was in there, I never heard of any open dissent, as you've asked for, from Indian troops towards a British officer. Now, I would imagine that is because these Indian troops were never alone. They were always with the other senior ranks, the subadars and the havildars, sergeants, sergeant majors, Indian ones, you know. And I presume that they would, if they had any objection to British troops, they never spoke it outright. And I never had any occasion to pull anyone out about it.
And you're saying British officers rely heavily on these halberdiers and other ranks, lower ranks?
British
NCOs.
The British officers rely really heavily on this, on the NCOs, halberdiers. When a chap from the Indian Army are found becomes a halberdier, he's really somebody. I'm looking back the time when I was a corporal and I was made sergeant. I was still a corporal in a sense, but I was a sergeant then. But in the Indian Army, when you became a halberdier, you were really somebody. And when you moved from a havildar to a subadar major, you were somebody. You were nearly commissioned then. You know.
The cultural differences in an Indian regiment of Italian, did they cause problems at all?
By the word cultural, I suppose you mean the way they behaved and the manner in which
the things they would eat and the things they wouldn't eat, that kind of thing.
Well, my first experience being in the Indian Army was sitting in the tents, no seats, just sitting cross-legged with the rest of them around, and you're just eating rice and chapatis and things like that. However, after a while, after a day or two, I got myself used to that and found out that in the case of British officers, it wasn't always so, sitting around like this and eating rice and chapatis. Because they used to have their own large tents, it's just like they used to go into, and they had more or less the same sort of rations you would have in the British Army. Because these were, although we all had to buy our own food, it wasn't issued by the government to us, we had to buy our own food, and the British officers would always get British types of food from brought up into the desert. With the Russians, it's just like when they came, you know.
You say you had to buy your own food, which is Western food, really. Was that a drain upon your salary or wage?
Well, in my case, I had no money. I was living on my wages as a second lieutenant, and previously that as a sergeant, 6 and 6 a day. And the only money I had, the largest amount of money I ever saw, was when I was commissioned in the college, and I was given a cheque for £50 Egyptian pounds, which I had to go and buy myself a complete set of uniform, officer's uniform, a complete set of uniform, a complete set of company equipment, bed, water bucket, carrier, water carrier, and all this. And we had to buy our own food, and we had to buy our own clothes, socks, shirts, everything. And to me, as not having any money behind me, I found it rather difficult.
Did that continue through your experiences in the Indian Army, this difficulty with making money meet the demands?
Yes, it was. In my case, it was a different sort of life when I left the desert and went across into India. It was a different sort of life altogether.
We mentioned the cultural differences. Did you have to tread very carefully with Indian troops because of things that you couldn't ask them to do, which you probably could have asked a Western soldier to do.
Well,
religious.
You had to, because I found out during the time I was in India and I was working with GSQ in Delhi as an intelligence officer, that I was dealing with a lot of work, a lot of cases which was going to be used in the unforeseeable future, which was a handover home rule to India. And I was dealing as an intelligence officer with the Indian civil population regarding the number of different religious groups there were. And it turns out, during the time I was there for 3.5 years as an officer, and eventually when I was serving as a captain in GHQ in Delhi and working from headquarters Kamti area near Nagpur, that there was nearly 300 different religious types in India, and these all had to be sorted out and reports made on them. And up to my time, I had already associated with, dealt with about 160, 170 types of different religions during my reports from my headquarters up towards Delhi, GHQ.
The Grenadiers, were they Hindu or Muslim?
There were Hindus, the Grenadiers. There were a mixed case at that time because they hadn't home rule. There was just India. It was all India, not Pakistan at that time when I was there. And the regiments, there was such a lot of mixtures in them. The majority of them were Hindus, which I dealt with. And the Bombay Grenadiers, I left the 3rd, 4th, and went to the 4th, 4th. And I met various people from the Mahar Regiment there. But the religions, it didn't seem to deter them or to hinder them in any way with the activity they were taking part in, the military activities they were taking part in.
What was your opinion, or is your opinion, of the Indian soldier?
The Indian soldier is one of the best soldiers you could ever wish to meet. You felt safe and proud that you were serving with them. When I say you felt safe, they give you that impression that they never went around shouting or yelling the heads off. They were there and they would speak quietly to you. And it was G Saab, Naheed Saab, but you always seemed to have the trust of them. I didn't have any qualms about going with them in anywhere, but I never went into any sort of action with the Indian troops as such, not into fighting. The contact I had with the Indian Army was more or less on a peacetime basis when I returned to India and was working from GHQ in Delhi. The only alternative to GHQ in Delhi was before I moved to GHQ in Delhi, I was sent up to the Northwest Frontier, far from the Khyber Pass, a place called Mardan, and the nearest village to Mardan was Nowshera, which wasn't very far from Rawalpindi and Peshawar. Those are the main towns in the vicinity. And our job at that time, the Bombay Grenadiers we were, was to more or less carry out acts of defence against tribesmen and rebels coming down from the hills. And we had lots and lots of forays with them when we used to come down and enter the tents and such like and steal the rifles and run away. And we used to have to go up and make forays up into the hills and try and get them back. That was mainly our job up there, was to try and create peace amongst them, our world peace, from the Afghanistan hills and into India. But it was after I'd been with the Bombay Grenadiers a short while that I had this serious accident which put me out of any warfare commitment. Where I had a skull fractured and such like. And I had to return.
This is when the truck went off the road.
I was moved from the 3rd, 4th Bombay Grenadiers to the 4th, 4th. And at that time I had been given a bungalow with furniture from another firm, other than which supplied the 4th Bomber Grenadiers. So I returned my furniture and I went down with the one of our local trucks, and the sepoy was driving it. And on the way back, after delivering the furniture, on the way back, he took us off the road. We went off the road. To cut a long story short, went off the road and into the 6-foot ditch, and I went through the windscreen. And I remember picking myself up, jumping across the ditch, and pulling the door open with the intention of switching the engine off. That's what was in my mind with the rear sight. No, that was what was in my mind then, to switch the engine off. And I just remember pulling the door open, intent to turn the engine off, and I knew no more. And I knew no more for 13 days. I was told I'd lain in that... I'd sunk down at the bottom of the trench, the ditch, by that time, after I couldn't get in. And I had lain there for about an hour and a half, before any word had got through to the regiment, and the ambulance came. But I can't remember any ambulance coming. And I was in the hospital in Noshira Hospital. I was in there 4 months, but I was, for the first 13 days, I was unconscious. I knew nothing for 13 days. On the 13th day, I vividly remember waking up, coming around in bed. I didn't know it was 13 days, of course. And there were two nurses, two sisters, one each side. And they were leaning across, and they were patting my cheek. Come on then, come on. And that's the first words I heard. And they were English sisters from the Queen Alexandra Imperial Nursing Service. And they're the most wonderful people I've ever met in my life.
But you took your Indian wounded back to India, and there you joined this other battalion of the Grenadiers. And that was the one on the Northwest Frontier, was it?
Yes.
What date would that be?
The date, British Military Hospital.
Was it 1942?
It was in April 1942. Was it?
And how long were you with them?
I had the accident on May the 1st, 1942, and it was 4:15 in the afternoon at Mardan. I was admitted to the British Military Hospital at Noshira on the 3rd of May.
When you came out, did you rejoin the unit up in Afghanistan?
British Military Hospital, Noshira, it's all blank. When
you came out, did you rejoin the same unit?
When I came out of hospital, they sent me, not back to my unit, they sent me up into Murray Hills to the Lady Roberts Convalescent Home. Now that is a very nice home up in the hills for officers, British officers. And I spent 3 months up there. I was given 3 months convalescence up in the Murray Hills. When I returned from the Murray Hills, I had orders move me from the 4th Battalion, the 4th Grenadiers, Bombay Grenadiers, to GHQ in Delhi.
And were you there until the end of your time?
Well, I had started to recover by that time from the accident. And it was whilst I was in GHQ in Delhi that I carried out my duties as an intelligence officer. I was appointed intelligence officer and given the rank of a captain shortly after I'd been there a while. And I was promoted to the rank of a captain. And I used to travel around from GHQ Delhi around to numerous outlying regiments with the cipher documents. I used to have them in a case and they were chained to my wrist. Now I travel around with them, and I used to travel for days, nights and days, right around such a big place. I used to travel with this, and Those chains were kept fastened the whole time until I had delivered the cipher document, because they had to be renewed every so often. Because if they weren't renewed, the various cipher documents would become property of the enemy then. People could steal them and such like, so I had to renew them regularly. And that was one of my jobs, was to go around and deliver them personally to the regiments outside. Eventually, after doing that for a few months, and getting to know the workings of the various regiments around, who were all on peacetime work, I was posted to a headquarters formation, headquarters Camp T area, which is just out, it was in headquarters Nagpur district. And that was my last posting before I had to return back to England. Being posted at the headquarters Camp T area was rather a very wonderful experience, because it was my first experience of having been in an outlying district, assisting in working with a brigadier, a brigade major, the staff captain A and the staff captain B, and myself as an intelligence officer. It was the first time in my experience as a brigade headquarters formation officer. And it was the experience, it was a wonderful experience. At that time, we had a brigadier called Brigadier Finlay, and he and his wife had the bungalow just outside the office, the officers, headquarters. And I was living with in a separate room in a bungalow with the staff captain A and his wife. And the staff captain A's wife used to look after me, because I was a single man, and I was more or less I was paying rent for the use of the room, and also paying for the cost of my food and such like. Now, this went on for quite a while. We had some lovely experiences in there as a headquarters formation, because we had in the headquarters itself, the brigadier's officers, we had six British sergeants in there who occupied six chairs along two or three long benches, and opposite them, on the other side of the room, was Indian ladies who were secretaries and clerks, and there was one person in charge of those five girls and one person in charge. And the person in charge, he called her Gulus Mehta. She was an Indian, and she was in charge of them. And I had occasion on one time for to drag the six sergeants away from the office, across to the office, because I had a complaint from this clerical officer that the sergeants would keep dropping the pens and pencils off the table opposite them. And they were going down, and they were looking across and looking up under the table at the legs of the typist, which is rather funny when it was. But this typist, she was in charge of these typists, and she came across and asked me, because as an intelligence officer in the headquarters formation, I was responsible for the internal security of that depot, of the more or less the homeliness of it, you know, the security of it. And domestic matters like that came under me, and she came across.
When did you sail to return to England?
It was in November. It's not in that one.
What year
I'm right
you
back
be?
On my. About 1945 now.
45. And you were coming home for demobilisation, were you?
Well, whilst I was in headquarters Camp T area, you asked me when I left for England. The exact date I can't tell you, but it was on one occasion when I was called out. My wife, my girlfriend, had arrived there by this time, and I had got married. She had come out from England. The brigadier had got her released from the Manchester aircraft factory where she worked. And I was living with my wife then, and we were sleeping outside in the under the mosquito nets. We used to sleep outside the bungalows, and it was that hot. And I had word at 7 o'clock one morning that I had to go. There'd been an ammunition depot explosion 120 miles away, for which I was intelligence officer. I had to go up and investigate the cause of it. So I left. I left my wife asleep, well, lying in bed, and I told her where I was going. And I'd been travelling for about an hour on a motorcycle. And I had another partner with me, another captain. We were both going up to, because it was such a long way, we couldn't go single-handed. We didn't go in single people. All two of us travelled together on journeys like that. And we were both on separate motorcycles, and I was on the inside of the road, the footpath side, and he was on the inside of me. And about 500 or 600 yards ahead of us, there was a host of monkeys playing around the road. And we blew our horns, and the monkeys went up into the trees. And when we got up to them, one of the monkeys jumped off the tree onto the side of the road and bounded along beside me and jumped into my front wheel. And I went head over heels, crumb-assaulted. And I was severely injured. I had severe injuries there. And it was tore all my knee. I showed you. Oh, this was torn out. My knee was torn open because there was bolts on top of the motorbike. It was a Norton 500. There was bolts keeping air cleaners on top of the petrol tank sticking out like that, and your knee was ripped open with the bolts sticking out from the motorcycle, not with the falling off the motorcycle onto the ground. But when I did fall, I'd hit my head again. And that set my old complaint away. And my mate, who had stopped by this time, he had stopped his motorcycle and he was walking towards me to pick me up. And along the road, there was an old bullock cart coming along with two bullocks pulling it. And he stopped the bullock cart, and him and the chap lifted me up from the road and put me onto the bullock cart, turned the bullock cart round, and set me off to go back to our headquarters. And he went back. When I started to go forward back to the headquarters, he went off roaring on his bicycle for help to get an ambulance towards to come and meet me. And I had gone for about a quarter of an hour, 20 minutes down the road when the ambulance came. I was taken straight into the hospital and Kamti in Nagpur, then the one in Kamti. And it was from there at the phone that I had, apart from the serious injury I had with the accident, the motorcycle accident, I had caused more injuries with my head problem under the fractured skull I had in 1942 when I first went across to India. And I was unable to really tell anybody my name. I was, had a very bad mental condition. Whilst I was in the hospital having treatment, I also developed meningitis, cerebral spinal meningitis. So I found that my wife was in a terrible uproar by this time. She was upset. And because they had gone along to the bungalow, the medical authorities had given orders for the bungalow to be all stripped and defumed. And my wife had gone to live with the staff captain's wife in her bungalow. And eventually, cut a long story short, I was sent for a medical check, and I had to resign, come back from India. It was in November when we got back home, so I would imagine it would be round about October when we set off from India to come home. It would take about 6 weeks to come home on a hospital ship. And when I returned at home, my wife was sent home to live with her mother because we hadn't a house to go to. And I was sent to Aldershot Hospital, and that's where we parted. From Aldershot Hospital, I was sent from there to Catterick Camp, to a hospital in Catterick Camp. And after a while at Catterick Camp, I was sent home, and I went to live with my wife again, who had by this time was living with her mother, and we lived with the mother.
So your army career finished in hospital, in effect?
My army career finished through that accident in the headquarters county area as I was going away to investigate this explosion at an explosion, at a munitions, ammunition depot at Umla. That's where the camp was, a place called Umla.
Have you kept in touch with the regimental associations, etc., after peace?
Not with the Indian...
The DLI, I'm thinking.
With the DLI. When I returned, I joined the Fellowship of Services. And I really kept going to those because I was being an organist. They needed an organist for to give them entertainment for the meeting nights. And I used to meet once a month with them. And I did that for about 6 or 7 years until this final business of having these 4 strokes, which I've had, prevent me from doing anything else. Now I'm, you see us sitting here, and that's the last. But the actual work which I did, for the actual job I did as a member of the 8th Battalion Dermalay Infantry, was when I attacked with a friend of mine King Fruit's Palace in Cairo to release the British ambassador.